Professor Galbraith, the officers of the College Young Democrats and College Young Democrats and guests here tonight, this is a better greeting than I usually receive from my college students, who when I first ran for Congress were most ardent in their support of me. I was never sure whether they wanted me to go to Congress or wanted me off the campus, and I never really tried to find out. In politics, it's best not to try to discover the sources of your support or of your strength. I've generally concluded that in politics, it's, well, really, even when you leave the college campus, it's not always what you're running for, it's what you're running away from. And this is a rule that one ought to at least keep in the back of his mind as he goes along the way of American politics. This has not been a very good year for the United States Senate. We look good only in contrast with the House of Representatives, and that's a... questionable comparison. I think we ought tonight to pay tribute, though, to one man who gave us the best Democratic Congress we've ever had. He's Kenneth Galbraith overlooked him, but the greatest liberal Congress we had was the Goldwater Congress following the election of 1964. And it's somewhat ironic that all of the things that Barry had opposed for some 15 to 20 years were, at least most of them, were finally enacted in that Congress, which he helped to give to us. You must understand the Senate, however, in passing judgment upon it. Even though this year we spent a month reorganizing the Senate with a bill that the House would not even take up, then we spent too much under the leadership of Senator Long providing for the financing of presidential campaigns. After 2 months and 24 votes, we recommitted the whole thing. We suggested that these should not be counted in the record among those senators who try to build up their voting record on a kind of quantitative basis. We've gotten so it's almost like professional basketball in the Senate, that if you don't vote every 20 seconds, they threaten to take the ball away from you and give it to someone else. But underneath all this, we are, I think, the last primitive society, the United States Senate. And there's a lot to be said for it. We have great reverence for our elders. We have great respect for occupancy, a kind of territorial imperative. If you've got offices, you hold on to them, and we're still trying to recover some of the offices that were held by a recent majority leader of the Senate. We keep discovering them in new corners of the Capitol. And this is the usual practice as someone moves out of the Senate. If we can discover the caves, we take them over. And of course, the ultimate test is trial by ordeal, which is reflected in the filibuster. It's been suggested if we just restored the duel that the work of the Senate would be greatly facilitated. But short of that, we proceed as best we can. And in this year, although it has not received as much attention as it should, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I want to say, has made several good tries and has achieved some things, I think, of significance. We raised the question of the independent operation of the Central Intelligence Agency 2 years ago, and were rather set back when our whole effort was sent to the Armed Services Committee, which is a committee of some status. But all was not lost. At the beginning of this session of Congress, somewhat condescendingly in any case, but nonetheless it was substantive, three members of the Foreign Relations Committee were included on what is called the Oversight Committee. That's not meant to be a derogatory term. That has substance. We didn't stop, really, with the effort on the CIA. And I suppose if we had known about the National Student Association and some of the other operations of the agency when we made our first effort, we might have succeeded in the open contest. We then proceeded last year and again this year to try to set some limitations upon the activities of the Defense Department in the sale and distribution of arms all around the world. Last year, our effort was, well, it was not successful, excepting as an indication and a warning as to what would come. But this year in the foreign aid, we have moved successfully to set limitations upon arms sales and distributions, at least as freely and as liberally as they were allowed before. And this caused great distress. We had protests from the State Department, for example, saying that this would seriously interfere with the modification and the modernization of the arms of Chiang Kai-shek's army on Taiwan. Well, this came out at the same time that we were told that we were getting to use BB guns in training our own troops. But for some reason, the modernization of the army of Chiang Kai-shek on Taiwan was considered as a priority by the State Department and by the Department of Defense. They also told us it would seriously interfere with the potential of the Greek army to defend liberty in that area of the world. And I'm not going to go down through the list, but this was about the measure of the defense which was made against a rather modest effort to set some limitations. We also proposed a limitation on the number of countries to which aid might be given. Secretary of State protested. He said it was irrational. But we asked him whether he would prefer to have us proceed rationally, and he said no, he wouldn't. And that we thought at that point we might designate the particular countries to which the aid would go, and the State Department position at that point was for the irrational suggestion that we set simply a limitation on the number of countries. We then moved on from that to what I think is the most serious area of controversy between the Congress and the executive branch of the government, the question of commitment. How is the United States committed? Who has the commitment to distribute? When does the commitment become a pledge of the national honor? And when is the whole reputation of the country to be put in the balance? Well, we've not proceeded very far in this discussion in the Senate, but we have opened up, I think, the most significant question. The administration spokesman in those hearings was the former Attorney General, who came up as an Assistant Secretary of State. And he proceeded in formal testimony to tell us about how the Constitution compels the Congress to support the foreign policy of an administration. He proceeded to tell us that it was a good thing if you could have the concurrence of the Congress with administration foreign policy, but the whole emphasis was that foreign policy was to be made by the administration and that Congress, if it had any role, was to fulfill a purely supplemental and a kind of endorsing role and responsibility. Well, we were going along with our limited scholarship until he finally said that Thomas Jefferson was on his side in favor of a strong executive in the field of foreign policy. And at this point, we decided that we really ought to raise the flag and say it can't be true. And of course, it is not true. Or was his whole presentation an acceptable one? For if it were to be accepted, it would be to acknowledge that we have under our constitutional system a kind of prescription for what comes very close to a four-year dictatorship of foreign policy. And this must not be allowed to stand either in fact nor in theory. And so in this year, 1968 coming on, the time has come, I think, for us to most seriously examine our whole approach to foreign policy. Not just the approach of the nation, but the approach of the political parties and particularly of the Democratic Party to which all of us here belong. And beyond that, to the approach and to the activities of the Young Democrats and also of the College Democrats. Because only every 4 years do we have a significant opportunity to give direction to foreign policy. Much of what Katzenbach said was true. Either by virtue of the Constitution or by the nature of events today, a president has great power and great influence in determining foreign policy. And only every 4 years does the nation have a chance to examine that policy very carefully and perhaps to give it a change of direction. There's nothing in our system which permits us to bring down the government between elections. If it had, I suppose that the Eisenhower government would not have brought it down. It would have collapsed once or twice a month. But in any case, this is the critical test, which you have to look at policy and look at procedures. Because once you're committed for the next 4 years, it is a fact that unless by some kind of violent opposition, the cutting off of appropriations, as some people suggest, or impeachment of presidents, as some people suggest. But there's no easy and simple way, certainly no way comparable in terms of its effectiveness, as that which is done in the course of the preparation for a national convention and the preparation for a national campaign. And in this process in America, the political party is all important. And we should recognize, all of us active in politics and active in the Democratic Party, that a political party is never an organization which is simply to be controlled. But it has to be organic. It has to be an instrument through which the judgment and the will of the people, those at least who take upon themselves the burden of participation in politics, can somehow be translated to bear upon policy and also upon program. We cannot accept that a political party is a kind of last man club or a device through which you protect either your office or your patronage, if that may be the case. A political party ultimately belongs to the people of the country. And in an election year, it must be the instrument of the people of the country. For what we seek to do by our participation in politics is to develop programs, to make choice of candidates, and to move on from that to gain control of the principal offices of this country. Not to hold them for ourselves, but rather that we may rule, we hope, and govern, we hope, for the good of the majority, and for the good of all, but by the determination of the majority voice in this nation. And I'm satisfied that the one rule of American politics is that when you reach a point where, in a sense, a minority position is prevailing, that somehow or other that government cannot continue to be effective. And in this process of redirecting policy, if it needs to be redirected, or developing new ideas, the College Young Democrats, I think in the year 1968 particularly, have a very great responsibility. Young Democrats oftentimes are expected simply to be available, to be silent, to distribute pamphlets and campaign literature, and sometimes simply to be urged to wait until the senior party calls upon them. Well, I can't feel too badly. This has happened to others. I was reading an essay about modern poets, the new poets, and I said, well, you know, these people are all 50 years old. And finally, as I read on down, the author said, well, you know, the trouble was that the young poets were first called young poets in 1916. And by a combination of advances in science and other things, they remained alive until about 1960, and only now can you start calling men who are 50 years old young poets, and the same is true in politics. The same was true with reference to the Marshall Plan. We were dealing with people of our own culture, essentially, and we could see that the benefits were going to come very soon, and supposedly this was going to help Western Europe stand against Russian communism, which was represented as a great threat to the entire free world. Intellectually rather clear and not calling for any great commitment in hope or in trust. Today, the young Democrats, as well as young people generally, don't seem willing to wait. I worry some about the generation gap, but we have a generation gap at my age in politics that I want to talk to you about. This is a kind of a common sympathy I think we might develop. But what usually happens in politics is that after a war, those who are involved in the war, that when you have that historical reality plus penicillin, why, you get what amounts to almost a two-generation gap in politics at about my age, so that we have this kind of common bond. I'm reaching back, really, for your understanding and for your sympathy. So here we are together, the young people of American politics, trying to examine and re-examine our position and our policies within the Democratic Party. And it is important that we do it within that party, because we can't really expect very much on the record from the Republicans. They have refused to face up to any of the hard and difficult problems that have faced this nation in this century. And when you consider that in 1964, they offered to the nation as a candidate, a man who had stood aside from the three significant intellectual and moral commitments that this nation, or that this government and this nation, through political action, had made while he was in the United States Senate. A man who had refused to support the Test Ban Treaty, who had refused to support civil rights programs, and who had even refused to support what was a kind of manifestation of new economic thought in the tax reduction bill back in 1964. These were not really very difficult challenges, and were in the areas in which you might have expected some response from Republicans, but they refused to participate and then offered to the nation a man who had stood against each and every one of them. We have had to act when the need of the nation was for war, and we have had to act when the needs of the nation were in the realm of peace. World War I and World War II, and in between, the demands of the nation reflected in the New Deal called for a response from the Democratic Party, and that response was forthcoming. And again, after World War II, when conditions had changed and when there was a lag in terms of the response to the needs of the nation, it was our party that was called upon to respond to that. And the response was really not a very demanding one. We like to take credit for what we acted upon in the 88th and the 89th Congress for things like medical care for the aged and a comprehensive program of education and the basic civil rights program and the modifications in the Immigration Act. These were significant achievements, but they'd all been with us and before us and the subject of political debate for nearly 20 years, and no one of them required any very great commitment of intellect in order to understand it. I mean, you didn't really have to be very intelligent to see the need for a comprehensive program of education or for medical care for the aged. It shouldn't have been difficult. I think the ultimate in that was the Undertakers group that testified against it on the grounds that it would disturb the traditional doctor-patient relationship. That, I think, was the turning point. After that, the medical profession lost heart. They didn't really fight it for their news. The civil rights bill, the basic civil rights bill dealing with the right to vote and trial by jury and due process, this was rather clear under the Constitution, although we had some Republicans who suggested we ought to act on it, as I remember, under the Interstate Commerce Clause. And the same was true of the revision of the immigration law, which obviously was an affront to every foreigner and to about 90% of the people of the United States. And it didn't require any very great moral commitment to respond to any one of these programs, because nearly everyone could see in each of them what might be called not necessarily a selfish advantage, but at least a personal advantage. You could say, well, I see how this is going to benefit my children if it was education, or my parents if it was medical care. You could anticipate the day when you yourself would benefit from it. The same was true with immigration. So a relatively easy personal response in each case. But this is not the case with the programs that we're called upon to deal with today, either the domestic programs or the international program. The problem of poverty, for example. This is a program without a constituency. It's very hard to see in poverty any kind of particular advantage to oneself, at least in the immediate and the direct way. It's rather difficult to understand the problem of poverty, as it is somewhat difficult to understand some of the other problems of urbanization. And as we move from the domestic scene to the international scene, the problem of understanding and of having a very clear view of what we ought to do or what we're trying to do becomes increasingly difficult. And at the same time, the intensification of the demand for moral commitment tends to increase. And this is true particularly with reference to Vietnam and all that it does relate to. And it's my judgment that this issue must be dealt with within the regular and the established processes of American political parties and American political party activity. This is not something to be left in isolated debate somewhere, not even to be left for debate in the Senate of the United States, not to be left to be dealt with third parties or some kind of splinter party, but a problem which must be taken up and faced in all of its aspects within the party which we claim, the Democratic Party. I would say somewhat distressed that leaders of our party should at this stage begin to call for unity and call for an end of dissent and to talk about the dangers of division within the Democratic Party. In our tradition, usually the call for unity comes out about the second day of the National Convention rather than at this stage of the process. And sometimes we don't even raise the cry of unity until 2 or 3 days after the convention is over. So I suggest that we really follow that same practice and tradition and precedent as we attempt to deal with this somewhat divisive issue. We did it in 1948 with the issue of civil rights, when it was said, don't raise this issue, don't raise it now, we'll deal with it after the convention. But the decision was then made to raise the issue, and I think that most of us who were involved in that campaign are satisfied that apart from the merit of the issue itself, the moral necessity to take it up, that it also turned out to be good politics, and without it, we would probably have lost the election of 1948. Allowing for all good faith and allowing that many party leaders are honestly and sincerely support the president's position, and allowing that many of them may be of mixed mind, as is true throughout the country, of other people, there must be many of them who are at this time remaining silent and in the name of the unity of the party are not saying what they should say. And I call upon them to speak out. This is an issue which should not be left to the academic community alone. It should not be left to the ministers and the rabbis, to the clergy of the country to carry it to the people. And it should not be left to the young people of America. This is not a time, this is a limited application, for a children's crusade. Children's crusades have never worked out very well. And in any case, the burden should not be put upon the young people. It's to your credit that you're willing to accept it. But I speak for some of the older people and those who've been around for some time saying that we should not expect you to carry the burden, nor to expect it to be carried by ministers and clergies, nor expect it to be carried by the academic profession. I don't want them to shirk their burden. They have been somewhat inclined to come slowly on some issues in American politics, but in this instance, they have moved out ahead of the politicians. And I think our demand must be to the politicians to follow very closely and very quickly. Now, what about the arguments made with reference to division and the need for unity and the consequence of some kind of contest within our own party? The question of dividing the party is, I think, almost irrelevant. The party, in my judgment, will not stay together if this issue is suppressed, if it is not discussed, if we do not have a contest over it. We are, I think, in not just in our party, but in American politics, in a rather strange condition. The lines of ideas and of ideological commitment that had begun to develop under Adlai Stevenson have tended to be dissipated. And the firm and promising and productive beginnings which were made in translating ideas into practical programs under John Kennedy have also been confused. But in politics as well as in American society, the old ability we had, or the possibility of seeing and distinguishing kind of the warp and woof of our society, this has been lost. And we deal almost with a kind of mass of felt in which there's no distinction as to which way the threads actually run. We used to think we could hear rather clear sound. We heard the trumpet from Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. I suppose it was a kind of trombone, but you could hear it. You could hear it, and the message came through. And some of my friends said that Adlai's was kind of a French horn, but those who heard it could never forget it. And the French horn echoes forever, Ron. And in the Kennedy administration, again, the sound of trumpet, and as they said, of drums also. But what we have now is a kind of confusion of tongues, really. It's as though, well, we had too many accordions playing at the wrong time, or at least in disagreement as to what the music actually was. This is not necessary to fault the administration or the party leaders, but under these circumstances, I think it is right to fault him some for saying, let us not look into the problem. Let us not try to sort this out. Let us not try to find the strands again and see if we can't put things back in order. They say it will bring about a Republican victory. Well, I don't think we can back off on that. From what I see of the Republicans, I think that we could beat them under almost any circumstances. And certainly, if this is to be the issue in the campaign, there's no indication that any Republican will have an advantage over a Democratic candidate. Then they get hard, you know, and get tough, as they say, and suggest that anyone who dissents is prolonging the war and therefore responsible for deaths. We've heard this a number of times, and if you say, or a public official says, well, I hate to think that maybe this death that we see here is in consequence of dissent and criticism. In effect, what you have then said is that if you're not sure about that one death, then you can't be sure about any death, and consequently you can say that all deaths in the war are the consequences of dissent and of disagreement. But we can't allow that argument in that case against us to stand. Well, they go on from that to say, really, you just don't understand history. This is the next argument, which goes to something more general. And always they start with Munich. I have a feeling that most people at the State Department began the study of history with Munich. And they go on from that. And we might suggest that there are some lessons in history that really go beyond Munich and somewhat in advance of it. And finally, we have the suggestion made by the Secretary of State in a recent press conference that somehow, if you do all of these things in the way of dissent and disagreement and don't support the war fully, and if we don't win it, that the country will be in mortal danger. And he talked about 1 billion Chinese with nuclear weapons. Well, we have nearly 200 million Americans, but only one of us has nuclear weapons. And I don't think that the specter of the billion Chinese with nuclear weapons is one that could possibly drive us to silence. And as a matter of fact, if we were moved by that figure of speech, or by that image, we would have every reason to be concerned as to whether or not the Vietnamese War was the way to deal with that problem. So on every count, the military analysis of it, in which we really are acting in contradiction of three great generals, at least we accept them as being great generals, who warned us against a ground war involvement in Asia, as well as General Gavin, who's come to the cause. We're running against the political arguments which are made against it by statesmen in almost every major country of the world, those on whom we have relied in the past, and particularly by men like Dean Acheson when he was writing as long ago as 1950, in which he warned that we should not become involved in an adventure in southeastern Asia. He said what we could do in that area was to supply the missing component. If all other things but one or two components were present, he said the United States could effectively intervene and participate. And he said even then it might not succeed. But what are we offering instead of that today? Something called nation building. Well, we know that we're trying to provide not only a missing component, not two or three missing components, but the representation we get is of an effort to establish an entirely new culture in southeastern Asia. And Acheson was right in 1950. This is not the kind of contribution, particularly when we attempt to make up for nearly all other deficiencies by intensifying our military effort. And as things tend to go somewhat worse and worse, I think we detect a disposition on the part of the administration to use more and more Latin words to describe what's happening. Now, I'm not necessarily against Latin words, but George Orwell wrote in 1946 that they were dangerous, he said, because they, as he describes it, they fall like gentle snow covering all of the indecencies of the landscape. And in politics particular, he said, be on guard. Now, I might point out that the church has recently moved away from Latin and given up some other positions like holy wars and the persecution of heresy and also the Latin language, and all of these seem to be, well, in the process of being picked up by the Defense Department. Most of their important words, like pacification and rectification, and the critical word, of course, is escalation, which somehow supposedly takes it apart from any kind of thorough and intrusive judgment on the part of the people. If you examine it in historical context, you're hard-pressed to find any competent historian who accepts the State Department's interpretation of the reality of China, or the plans of China, or even their interpretation as to what is in store for Southeastern Asia. And finally, of course, we reduce it to the point of moral judgment. We assume that all these other judgments were right, which they are not. We're ultimately called upon to pass a moral judgment upon our involvement in Vietnam. First is to the objectives, and I suppose that at one time the early and rather simple objectives were acceptable and defensible. But what you have had is a kind of escalation of objectives to go along with the escalation of the military commitment in South Vietnam. From a rather simple objective of preserving and establishing and protecting a free society in South Vietnam to a more complex one of transferring a kind of great society to that area, to building a nation, to a more recent one saying, here all of Southeastern Asia is involved, and finally to the Rusk statement of the objective as being a kind of early confrontation of China on the Asian continent. And as this has taken place, also the methods that are used in the war, not just in a quantitative way, but also in a qualitative way, have also escalated. And the difficulty of justifying them on moral grounds has increased as that change has taken place both quantitatively and qualitatively. And finally, we're reduced to passing a moral judgment in terms of proportion. And this is one on which we must stand, even though we may be satisfied as to the rightness of the objectives and the justification of the methods, as to whether or not there is a proportion between what we will achieve with victory in South Vietnam and on the other hand, the loss of life, the destruction of life and property that will be the cost of that victory. And in this scale, in my judgment, you can find no justification for the continuation of the war. I would quote for the individual conscience some lines written by Charles Peguy on the Dreyfus case, when he said, one single injustice and one single crime, one single illegality, if officially confirmed, one single hurt done to law and justice, above all, he said, if legally, nationally, and generally accepted, this one single crime breaks and suffices to tear the whole fabric of society and to dishonor a whole people. And also another reference in somewhat broader social and national context, which I think we must also keep in mind since the individual judgment is so difficult to make, that of Toynbee in writing about the Roman Wars with Carthage, in which he said that in consequence of that victory, the fabric of Roman society was so tattered and so neglected, and the responsibility of Rome to the empire so disregarded that the republic fell and was succeeded by the dictatorships.
You'll have plenty of time to demonstrate tomorrow. Would it be impolite to suggest that you just had him and that we might move on to the next phase? Very briefly, let me just make a couple of introductions that people I didn't notice among us before. The rear of the room, there are sometimes, those of us in Massachusetts are not sure when we refer to our Democratic colleagues in the legislature what the responses that we're going to get. I want to introduce a gentleman in the rear of the room to whom I think for this audience there's no question but that the response should be enthusiastic approval, State Representative Joseph Bradley of Newton. And I violate no confidence when I point out that he's a candidate for Congress next year. We start campaigns early or never end them. Also, seated down here to my right, nobody really understands the Cambridge proportional representation system. We do deliberately much worse than the Vietnamese by accident and incompetence, but I believe Mrs. Ackerman has been elected. If that's the case, this is Mrs. Barbara Ackerman, newly elected Cambridge City Councilor. We also have